Trib Live Radio presents Off-Road Politics from Main Street to the Beltway with Selena Zito, reporter at the Pittsburgh Trib, and Dr. Laura Brown, a professor at George Washington University. Trib Total Media, see what's next. Now, here's your host, Selena Zito.
Hi, this is Selena Zito, reporter and columnist at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review and your co-host for Off-Road Politics. Welcome back. And we have Laura Brown here from George Washington University, who we have not been able to connect with because Ms. Brown has been in Iowa, New Hampshire, and you're finally back. Welcome back to the show, Laura.
Thanks. It's great to be back. It's fun to be out on the road, but it's always good to come home.
Always good to come home. So we've had quite a week this week. The week began with Jim Webb, the former Republican turned Democrat, who was running under the Democrat ticket for president. He dropped out of the race. He scolded both parties for their behavior and for the highly partisan rhetoric and the everything that we see every day in politics. He took it to task, which was followed by Vice President Joe Biden stepping out onto the Rose Garden lawn with President Obama. He also dropped out of the race that he never was in, but the speculation was running high that he was going to jump into the Democratic nomination process. He also scolded his party and actually mainly his party for the heavy rhetoric and said that he will not be silent in this race. Then in Iowa, we have seen what you and I have been talking about for a while. We've seen Donald Trump, the numbers finally starting to show him dropping in the first contest state. He's now almost 10 points behind physician Ben Carson. I still believe we're in the whack-a-mole process where somebody's going to rise and then fall, and Trump had his moment. And I think you'll see Carson have his moment, and then I think you'll see people start to, other people to start get attention. And finally, we had Benghazi committee, the House Select Committee on what happened September 11th, 2012 in Benghazi, where four men lost their lives, including a U.S. ambassador. And Mrs. Clinton was on the stand, I believe, for 11 hours yesterday. Now, it was broken up. It wasn't all at one time, but it was quite the spectacle. So what do you think about the week, Laura?
Well, it's been quite a week, as it always seems to be these days. Politics is very fun, and there's no doubt if you can kind of step back from the high intensity of the emotions, it really is kind of an amazing theater.
Absolutely. I forgot to mention Paul Ryan, who began the week saying, who ended last week by saying that he was not going to, he was not seeking the speakership. And they all come back from recess on Monday. He starts meeting with some members privately. There's about three or four different factions in the House Republican caucus. Three out of the four of them are pretty moderate. And the fourth one, the one with the most noise, is the Freedom Caucus. By the middle of the week, Ryan had won them over with where he would take the House Republicans and the whole House. And he's just, when you become Speaker, you're not Speaker of just your party. You're the Speaker of the entire House, all 435 seats. So I guess I really want to ask you, before we get to Hillary, what are your thoughts about Ryan?
Well, I think it's a good choice for the Republicans in the sense that he is somebody who appreciates process and policy, and he is someone who has worked with Democrats. In fact, he worked with Senator Patty Murray in crafting one of the compromises that we've seen in the last couple years. So I do think that what this means for the Republican is that they are going to have a functioning House of Representatives. That doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's going to be happy, or that Paul Ryan is really actually going to even have, I would say, the powers that John Boehner wielded. I mean, I do think he's coming into a weakened speakership. I do think the party overall is demanding kind of more say from your rank and file members. And I think that's what you're going to see. You know, whether this goes fully back toward kind of a Rayburn time, that, you know, we have a long ways to go before something like that occurs.
Explain a little bit about Rayburn so that people understand. I mean, outside of some people knowing that's the name of a building, I don't think they understand who this Texas Democrat was, Sam Rayburn. He served when FDR was president, and he was a longtime friend of LBJ, or sometimes friend. They had a very weird relationship.
Well, and I think what's important about Rayburn's speakership, really from an institutional perspective and to think about it in relation to Paul Ryan, is that what happened during Rayburn's speakership was really this coalition of Southern conservative Democrats and Northeastern, in particular, liberal Republicans. And they came together oftentimes kind of against the wings of either party and governed really from a sort of somewhat middle point. Now, the interesting part about that is Rayburn, because of this, also had to kind of, I would say, govern delicately. You know, he really had to let a lot of his members do what they needed to do for their local politics, and he let them not cast votes. He was not somebody who strong-armed a lot of people, and he didn't have the powers. In fact, if you look at Congress in that time, what you see is that the seniority mattered a great deal, and the committee chairs mattered a great deal. So the committees and the subcommittees in some ways essentially ruled the House rather than just the speaker and the party leadership. And one of the things that Newt Gingrich did was completely revolutionize that. He decided to make committee appointments based upon essentially party loyalty, not upon seniority. He tossed out some high-ranking senior people who were ready to take over their committees. He put party loyalists in those positions. And ever since Gingrich and those reforms, the House has been governed that way. So it was governed that way under Gingrich, under Pelosi, and under Hastert, and to a certain extent under Boehner. And what this Freedom Caucus really was also arguing for, it wasn't just conservative legislation. It was more involvement with sort of the actual legislating itself. So more of open rules, meaning that when bills come to the floor, there can be amendments placed upon it. Just more debate, more deliberation, and quite frankly, what that really means to people who aren't familiar with legislative processes is, in some ways, more gridlock, because things are just going to take a heck of a lot longer and to move forward.
We're already designed to be gridlocked. This will even be worse.
That's exactly right. So the interesting part is the Freedom Caucus may get kind of precisely what it is they didn't want, which is, essentially a much more deliberative process, which then is a much less effective one. And they've been clamoring that, you know, they have all this power in Washington. Why is it that they can't move things forward? Well, quite frankly, this will only make the House look a little bit more like the Senate in terms of an ability to filibuster and things like that.
Oh, boy. Sounds like it's going to be fun leading up to the election with the process sort of going at even a snail's, more of a snail's pace. Do you think there's any impact with all the shenanigans at all in terms of the majority in the House?
No. I mean, I will say that at the end of the day, I actually wrote a blog about this for U.S. News and World Report, that really at the end of the day, we have to realize that what appears to be incredibly turbulent and upsetting in our politics is not even close to sort of the politics that we experienced during the Gilded Age. So we are kind of surprised because in comparison to kind of a quiescent period that we had in governing prior to sort of this more modern Gingrich period, you know, people are somewhat surprised. But when you look back and you look at the Gilded Age, I mean, there was an election in 1894 where the Democrats lost 125 seats.
Absolutely.
It was 35% of the House seats at the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, the most we've had in the modern era sort of be a loss was the 63 seats in 2014, and that's only represents 15% of the chamber.
Right.
So we're not really having the kind of upheaval that I think some people think.
Right.
I mean, we've reelected incumbent presidents. You know, we are in some ways much more regimented and regularized and institutionalized than we really ever have been.
Those are excellent points. If you aren't following Lara on Twitter, it's at LaraBrownPhD. And you can also check out her blog on U.S. News World Report. What's the name of the blog again, Lara? I should know this.
The blog is called the Thomas Jefferson Street Blog.
Thank you so much. My brain is just gone.
It's okay. U.S. News and World Report, for those outside of Washington, D.C., actually, their headquarters is on Thomas Jefferson Street in Georgetown.
There you go. So let's talk a little bit about the House Select Committee hearings on Benghazi with Hillary Clinton yesterday. I would argue that most people did not watch it with, you know, intensity, as much intensity, or without leaving their television sets, like those of us who either are covering it or are, you know, in Washington and part of the process, or are in Washington and political junkies. In other words, it was not watched by most Main Street Americans. But I would say that people probably would catch a view of it either at the bar, or, you know, at the beauty salon, or at their work, where they can see but not hear everything that was happening. And so with those optics in mind, what are your sort of thoughts about what you walk away with from this meeting, from the hearings yesterday?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, let's face it, most Americans are working on most Thursdays.
Yeah, so, there's that.
You know, most people are not able to sort of be glued to their television set. And I had a day yesterday where I really couldn't follow politics because I was in a series of meetings and I was driving around New Hampshire. And the one time I stopped at, you know, a great little kind of bar food pizza place that had television screens all over, the hearings were on, but I couldn't read the closed captioning because it was too far away. And the only thing that I saw was sort of Hillary constantly resting her face on her hand and sort of looking bored.
Right.
And I will tell you that I just immediately thought to myself, who coached her to do that, or why is she doing that? Because at the end of the day, as somebody, you know, who thinks about political campaign ads, I just immediately saw that being kind of clipped away and put into a television ad with, you know, text or a voiceover that essentially said, you know, don't you want a president who cares about lives lost, you know, but to terrorists? So, I mean, I looked at that and I thought, this really isn't necessarily a good perception. And I would think that even if she's trying to make the point that this whole panel is partisan, that looking bored by the proceedings is not the right demeanor.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the exact same impression. I mean, I work in a newsroom, so televisions are everywhere. It was on everywhere. I was surrounded by it. But, you know, I looking at it as a regular person, you know, I think that there was a lot to be left for Mrs. Clinton in that position. Now, I think what did happen is that it brought her more Democrats who were wary of her, but it did not, and it made Republicans, you know, dislike her even more. But what it didn't do is convince independent voters, which is, you know, that's sort of the smushy middle that you have to convince to come out and vote for you in a general election. She did herself no favors with those voters. They are the most skeptical voters. They are the ones that don't wear the blue jerseys or the red jerseys.
Well, I think you're 100% right about that. And I do think that it was important for her in the sense that it shored up her partisan base, you know, which was concerned about this. Earlier in the week, they had been concerned about Joe Biden. Prior to that, they had been concerned about her performance in the debate. She has really had, in some ways, a good few weeks. You know, she had a strong debate performance. Joe Biden decided not to actually step in. Her poll numbers have been increasing. And, you know, according to Democrats who watched that hearing yesterday, it was, you know, a partisan witch hunt, and she did just fine. And so I think this is where what we're going to see in 2016 is a really interesting question, and that is, will the base matter more than the independents?
Right.
You know, we've had a number of elections now. You know, essentially 2004 and 2012 were both really base elections.
Right.
They were ones where weak incumbents implored their own partisans to turn out in large numbers and prevail over a challenger that those incumbents were able to sort of describe as unacceptable
right.
to fill the office.
Yeah, yeah.
So if Hillary is running as, if you will, a de facto incumbent, then that's what we're looking at in terms of a race, and that's what really their strategy is. And the only thing they actually care about is making sure that Obama's coalition doesn't dissipate.
Right, and I can't see her running as anything else. It makes the most sense to me. That might change. Certainly, we're in a very incredibly weird election cycle. Finally, your thoughts on Carson overtaking Trump in Iowa. I know it's only one state. I know it's only Iowa. Nonetheless, these states, as they march on through the primary process, matter because you need delegates to win the nomination. It's not a national primary. It's an incremental process. And, you know, Iowa, you know, I personally think that Carson's not the last person to hold first place in that state. I think that we'll see a couple other before the first vote is cast. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, I think what we are still seeing is that a tremendous number of caucus goers and those who are regular kind of activists in the party, they're just not wanting to back kind of a traditional candidate, somebody with political experience, somebody who has, you know, in one way or another, been on the stage and been a politician. And I think Carson is now kind of gaining from Trump's losing. And I think what you see is that people appreciate and like Carson because of his, you know, medical pass as a doctor, all of his signs when you go out to Iowa and New Hampshire, they all have the word on it, heal. And I found that very interesting
yeah.
because what he's really trying to say as a message is, as a doctor, I'm going to help heal this country. And I think that is a very different kind of emotional connection to voters than was Trump's, which is basically, you know, I'm just going to fight and we're going to win because I always win and everybody else is a loser. So
everybody else is a loser in his world. It's amazing.
Yeah. So Carson, I mean, I do think has a very different persona, has a very different type of message, is in some ways attracting the same voters, but for different reasons. So people who are now a little bit tired of Trump's bluster are sort of, I think, comforted by Carson's bedside manner.
Absolutely. Okay, so coming up next week, we will have Who knows? Because because it is the year of hashtag who knows. And I think anything could happen. Oh, wait a minute. The block of granite dropped out today. Lincoln Davenport Chafee dropped out of the race. He had a total of 10 people who donated to him in the entire cycle. I don't believe he registered on any of the polls at all. I don't even think he gathered 1%. Nonetheless, his moment in the limelight is now over. I guess we'll all be holding our breath, though, to find out who he is going to endorse, that all-important endorsement.
Yes, and the thing that's interesting about both Webb and Chafee dropping out is really what you're going to see is a smaller debate stage.
Right.
And so the next Democratic debate, which is in the second week of November, is really going to have O'Malley, Clinton, and Sanders. And each one of them is going to have much more time, and it's going to be even more focused, than the last debate, and certainly much more so than the Republican one.
Oh, yeah, the Republican one is next week in Boulder. Were you going to be attending that?
No. Thankfully, I'm going to be home watching on television.
Yeah, that feels like such a safe, normal place to be at. Well, even when you're a reporter covering the debates, I think people have this idea that we're all the reporters are in the room, furiously typing or scribbling on our notepads or texting or taking selfies if we are one of those reporters. Nonetheless, we're in another room and we may as well be in our living room because you're just not in there. So, you're not up close and personal. You don't get to see the people's reactions. You don't get to hear them. It's not like being in the room.
Well, when you first told me that, I was incredibly surprised, right? So this is where I think covering politics is sometimes, even more funny than doing what I do, which is sit around and analyze it from really far away. And I realized, maybe journalists don't get sort of, that front row seat.
No.
They are in some ways, as much behind the scenes, and in the back rooms as we are.
Scholars. I cannot remember what I was covering. I was on the Clinton bus or plane, I can't remember, 2008. But we were in a men's room and I was sitting beside a urinal. It's not the glamorous life you sometimes think it is. I don't think it was a debate, but I can't. No, it wasn't a debate. It was one of her events. But that has stuck in my head forever.
Yeah, really amazing. I mean, the bathroom, that's exactly where you want to hang out.
So next week, we'll be talking on Off-Road Politics about what happened at the Republican debate. I suspect by the time we have our show next week, by the time next Friday rolls around, that there will probably be a handful of people that drop out of the race. Probably two or three of them. So, there are people that are consistently polling below 0%, like Rick Santorum, Governor Bob Jindal from Louisiana. So we'll see what happens. Unless one of them have a breakout moment, and that can always happen in a debate, I suspect next Friday you and I will probably be talking about someone dropping out of the race.
I think that's right. And it's not a bad thing because we are approaching the contest, and we do need to have this race, I think, focus on at least a handful of people who really are legitimate candidates.
Well, that's what presidential politics does. It willows people down. Laura, thanks so much for being on the Off-Road Politics again. It's always so wonderful to have you on the show. You can follow Laura on Twitter at L-A-R-A Brown, PhD. No, is there an M in there?
There is, for my middle name.
Oh my God, I forgot the M. And at Brown, PhD. And you can also follow her blog, the Jefferson Street blog, right?
Yep, Jefferson Street blog at U.S. News and World Report.
Thank you, Laura. Until next week. Thanks, guys.